I would hope that people are not fearful of the changes this is going to bring to the state.
The state drops its legal challenge to land into trust for Alaska tribes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the governor's new oil and gas advisor has one mission.
There's no doubt in my mind that there's opportunities to make more oil with existing infrastructure and existing producing wells.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees in business, human resources, management, and accounting, all created with the flexibility and convenience of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The state of Alaska is dropping its lawsuit over federal regulations that banned Alaska tribes from putting land into trust, calling it dead-end litigation. But as KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, that doesn't mean the state sees smooth roads ahead.
Trust status for tribal lands transfers title to those lands to the federal government and protects the land from taxation or seizure for debt, and it gives tribes greater jurisdiction. Trust lands include reservations. They're a long-standing and common feature of land management for lower 48 tribes. But trust lands are scarce in Alaska due to a 1970s Department of Interior opinion saying trust status conflicts with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA. That legal interpretation meant Alaska tribes were banned from putting lands into trust until now. In 2006, five tribes and one individual sued to force the Interior to accept trust land applications from Alaska tribes. The state of Alaska intervened, saying allowing tribes to put land into trust would diminish state sovereignty. But a D.C. district court sided with tribes, ruling in 2013 the ban was arbitrary and capricious. The state is dropping its appeal of that ruling because new Interior Department regulations have since been issued, allowing Alaska tribes to put lands into trust. Corey Mills is the Department of Law's public outreach coordinator.
They have this new regulation, and we're going to go forward and work with the federal government, work with all interested stakeholders in Alaska, and see how Alaska's unique circumstances can fit into the lands into trust process that has occurred in the lower 48. We'd kind of have to make it our own just because of, you know, the unique situation we have here.
Alaska's unique situation includes state ownership of subsurface rights, for example, and ANCSA and the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Mills says it's not clear how well those laws will mesh with land into trust statutes.
So the question is, when you're taking lands into trust, how do all of those federal laws on trust lands interact with the statutes that determine, you know, how the state functions and the state's relationship with the federal government and the state's relationship with the land and fish and game management? All of those kind of issues will be something we'll have to think about.
Mills says Alaska may need new regulations or rules on how trust status will work here.
Our hope is to kind of come to the table early before these applications, there's any specific application granted, so that we can work through the issues in advance instead of after the federal government has already acted on one of the applications.
The Chilkoot Indian Association in Haines is one of the plaintiffs in the case. Speaking to KHNS in July, Tribal Administrator Harriet Brulette said the changes are not as momentous as some may fear.
I would hope that people are not fearful of the changes this is going to bring to the state. I know that there are folks who think that it's going to change the way people hunt and fish in the state of Alaska, but really it's not. A lot of times in Indian country, when tribes are sovereign entities and they write their own laws, they're usually not that much different than what the United States or the state of Alaska laws are. So I don't think that this is going to cause a huge upheaval in the state of Alaska like some people are thinking it is.
Brulette says the way she sees it, putting land into trust status simply gives tribes greater ability to take care of their land.
What this will do is give us some sovereign authority over our own land so that we can make decisions just like any other tribe in the lower 48 does about how we use our land. And we, like any other sovereign nation, we won't have to ask permission from anybody but ourselves. And we make the decisions about how our land is used.
In a prepared statement, Attorney General Jonah Lindemuth stated that if the state's concerns, quote, cannot or are not addressed by the federal government, resolutions of disputes in court remains an option, end quote. The Department of Interior can start considering applications to take Alaska lands into trust on August 22nd. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A man died in state custody yesterday afternoon at the Wildwood Correctional Complex in Kenai. 57-year-old Michael Talcott was found unresponsive in his cell, says Department of Corrections spokesperson Corey Allen Young.
It was found by a cellmate who said that Mr. Talcott collapsed after informing corrections staff and medical staff. They were attempted to save him through efforts of CPR and defibrillator. And also the emergency responders from the Nikiski Fire Department attempted to help, but he was pronounced dead at 4:48 p.m. on Sunday.
Talcott was not being treated for a medical condition at the time of his death, nor did his body show any signs of trauma. His death is being investigated by the state troopers, the state medical examiner's office, and the Department of Corrections. Talcott had been in custody since 2008. He was serving a 20-year sentence for sexual assault of a minor in the first degree. He is the seventh person to die while in custody this year. Governor Bill Walker's administration hasn't always had the smoothest relationship with Alaska's oil and gas industry. Now he's trying to change that. He's created a new cabinet-level position, appointing former oil executive John Hendricks to reach out to companies. But as Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, Hendricks plans to take a tough love approach to the state's largest industry.
John Hendricks says he's been hired to do pretty much one thing: figure out how Alaska can produce more oil.
There's no doubt in my mind that there's opportunities to make more oil with existing infrastructure and existing producing wells.
In his newly created role as the governor's chief oil and gas advisor, Hendricks doesn't have a department to run. Instead, his job is finding out what's standing in the way of oil production, from federal regulations to financing to state policy, and then doing everything he can to remove those barriers. But he says he's also challenging oil companies to step up. He calls it putting grit in the system.
If you have potential and you're not going after that production potential that's in the ground, why aren't you?
One example of this approach is the current controversy over Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe is the state's largest oil field and would be the largest source of natural gas if a pipeline is ever built from the North Slope. This year, for the first time, the Walker administration requested information from Prudhoe's leaseholders, BP, ExxonMobil, and ConocoPhillips, asking how they plan to market that gas. The companies have so far refused, arguing the request is potentially illegal. In return, the state has rejected the unit's annual development plan, essentially threatening the company's leases if the information isn't handed over. Hendricks says the state is well within its rights.
Let's go back to grit. This is kind of like the grit the governor provided to the oil and gas companies. I don't think they've had anybody ask those questions for a while, and so it was kind of shell-shocked about where the boundary are. You know, you're invading my space.
But he says that's the whole point.
This office needs to know, what is the potential of every oil field out there? What are your exploration plays? And why are you not exploring? And if you had something you explored that can be developed, why aren't you developing it? And I want to know how I can help.
A Homer High School grad, Hendricks most recently served as the general manager of Alaska operations for Apache before it pulled out of the state earlier this year. Now he's one of three new faces at the top of Governor Walker's oil and gas team, along with Andy Mack, the new commissioner of natural resources, and Keith Meyer, the head of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. As the administration describes it, Meyer is in charge of gas, Mack is focused on wrangling more flexibility out of the federal government, and Hendricks is in charge of oil. Another gritty issue for him? Oil and gas tax credits. Walker vetoed about $430 million in payments owed to companies this year. One of Hendricks's first tasks is reaching out to companies affected by the veto. And he says he supports the governor's decision.
I'm wondering if the John Hendricks who was running Apache a couple years back would have had the same reaction to the governor's veto.
Oh, yeah.
Ultimately, he says the state can't spend money it doesn't have. Perhaps counterintuitively, Hendricks says his real job is building an Alaska that doesn't rely so heavily on oil and gas. He hopes to use oil and gas as a bridge to that future.
As a child and as a young adult, I'm always looking up saying, why aren't they doing something? And now you look back when you're 59 years old and you say, well, maybe it's time you step forward and do it and help out.
And Governor Walker is hoping Hendricks and his gritty conversations can get the state a little closer to that goal. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting personal with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
I'm a pussycat inside. So it's really hard when people say they're scared of me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Anchorage bar owner Bernie Sapanavong submitted thousands of signatures today to run for Congress. Sapanavong is running as an independent for Alaska's only seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He gathered some of the signatures at his bar, Bernie's Bungalow in downtown Anchorage. If the Division of Elections validates his petition, Sapanavong will appear on the November ballot. Alaska's incumbent congressman, Republican Don Young, is trying to get on the general election ballot by winning tomorrow's Republican primary. Young faces three other Republicans, Gerald Hikas, Jesse Tingley, and Stephen Wright, all from the MATSU. Democrat Steve Lindbeck of Anchorage faces two other Democrats in tomorrow's primary, Lynette Marino Hins of Anchorage and Bill Hibbler of Fairbanks. Two Libertarians from Fairbanks are also running, Jim McDermott and John Watts. Among all the candidates running for U.S. House, only two have raised more than a token amount of campaign cash, Young and Lindbeck. United States Associate Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor spoke at the University of Alaska Fairbanks yesterday. Sotomayor, the first Latina appointed to the nation's highest court, addressed a capacity audience in Fairbanks. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Sonia Sotomayor shared a very human perspective on the Supreme Court. The 62-year-old Associate Justice traced her path to the nation's highest court from her New York City upbringing, where she says she took charge of her life at a young age after being diagnosed with diabetes and given an uncertain health future.
I understood then that I had to live every minute of my life as fully as I could.
Sotomayor went on to become an outstanding student, graduating from Princeton and Yale and working her way through the legal system, ultimately being appointed to the Supreme Court by President Obama in 2009. She says she initially felt like an outsider, but learned from other justices, including John Paul Stevens, who she says emphasized the importance of speaking out.
Because there is a pull in a group setting, in a collective, for people to try to agree with each other. And that's not unimportant, but every once in a while, You have to make a statement because it's important to make.
The opposite of a stern judge, Sotomayor spent the hour and a half UAF Summer Sessions event walking around the Davis Concert Hall, answering questions while shaking hands and sometimes hugging and taking pictures with audience members.
¿Cómo te llama?
Viviana.
Ah, Viviana, mucho gusto.
Seis horas para venir a verme. They came 6 hours to come see me.
Wow.
Sotomayor fielded a range of questions compiled over the summer, asked what the most important attribute for a high court justice is. Sotomayor singled out curiosity.
Experts in the sciences, in medicine, in every human endeavor come to court to ask us to answer their questions. And the only way we can do that is, do we have sufficient curiosity?
Sotomayor was also asked about her experience as a woman on the male-dominated high court. She reiterated a story told to her by fellow Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
There's a lot of moments I say things at conference, and it's like I'm not heard. And somebody will come after me, and they say exactly the same thing. And all of a sudden, it's brilliant.
Sotomayor emphasized the importance of women projecting their voices like an actor or singer and being assertive, noting she's considered tough.
I'm a pussycat inside. So it's really hard when people say they're scared of me because I can't understand why. At least myself, I can't understand why. But I do think that I've been blessed with an assertive personality.
Asked to give advice to Alaska Native students entering the university, Justice Sotomayor pointed to the significance of shared values, saying there is nothing innately wrong with the majority.
It is a majority because that's the way life is. They've been here, they grew this community, they've created this world. Learning about it will teach us some things that will be valuable for our native villages or for our native homes. And some things we can look at and say, you guys got it wrong.
Justice Sotomayor also met with students while at the university. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska's top military official is stepping down. On Tuesday, following a change of command ceremony at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Lieutenant General Russell J. Handy will retire after 34 years in the U.S. Air Force. For the last 3 years of his tenure, Handy has overseen Alaskan Command, the 11th Air Force, and Alaska Operations for the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD. Taking Handy's place is Major General Kenneth Wilsbach, who most recently directed operations at U.S. Central Command based in Florida and tasked with overseeing operations across North Africa and the Middle East, including Iraq and Afghanistan. He'll be promoted to a 3-star general ahead of taking all 3 appointments under his new command. Earlier in his career, Wilsbach was a fighter pilot and served out 2 assignments at Air Base Elmendorf in Alaska between 1998 and 2002.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Alaska Miners Association will protest a proposed Bureau of Land Management plan for the Eastern Interior. The recently released plan, covering 6.5 million acres, includes environmental protections that would ban new mining on more than 1 million federal acres, including 2 areas in the mineral-rich 40-mile region. AMA Executive Director Deantha Crockett says multiple use should be more prioritized in the plan.
This isn't just wildlife. This isn't just a recreational area. There's very promising mineral potential in the area that needs to be considered and not just deemed an exclusive use that would conflict with any other use there.
The AMA was one of numerous stakeholders that provided input during the BLM plan's 8-year development, and the resulting proposal also includes a recommendation that 1.7 million acres be open to new mining claims, much of it in the 40 Mile District. That hinges on approval by the U.S. Interior Secretary, and Crockett says she's suspect.
BLM has made commentary that they tried to strike a balance between conservation and mineral development, but when you get into the specifics of what land was quote-unquote opened for development, it's not actually open. It was recommended for development and has been on the desk of the Secretary of Interior for over 5 years now.
Crockett says the AMA does not have a great deal of faith that new lands will be open to mining. She adds that a 30-day protest period for the BLM's Eastern Interior Management Plan is happening while miners are in the field, some out of reach of easy communication. Senator Lisa Murkowski wrote the BLM last week, urging the agency to extend the protest period to 120 days in total and establish a supplemental protest period during October. Anchorage just recorded its warmest month on record. July was 4 degrees above normal, with an average temperature of nearly 63 degrees. Brian Brett-Schneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of a new segment, Ask a Climatologist. Brett Snyder told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit that record or near record warmth has extended across the state from January through July.
And when you add all that up, it puts 2016 way out in front in first place for the warmest year on record. In fact, it's the first time for the first 7 months of the year that Alaska has been, on average, above freezing. And there's a large gap between the first and second place year.
And what does that mean for the rest of the year?
Well, the fact that it has been so warm for the first 7 months doesn't necessarily mean anything for the next few months. But if you ask yourself, well, why has it been so warm for the first 7 months, the factors that have made it so warm are continuing. So we would expect that there would be warm months for the rest of 2016 and for 2016 to almost certainly become the warmest year on record for Alaska.
Why has it been so warm? What are those factors?
Well, there's several factors. One is globally, we're the warmest year on record. The last few years have been the warmest years on record. So globally, we're starting with this very high baseline. And then here locally, Alaska is surrounded by waters that are at or near all-time record highs, Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea. So we're just surrounded by this envelope of warm, moist air over this record warm sea surface temperatures. And there's really no place where air can cool off before moving over Alaska.
Brian Brett-Schneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Peppered across the state in 56 communities are small clusters of shipping containers. Inside them, you'll find the frontline defense for oil spills. They're placed and stocked by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Recently, a team from DEC and the Coast Guard was in Dillingham to demonstrate when and how to put that defense to work. KDLG's Shaylin Cochran has more.
The boom out there in the water to sort of make it, you know, an arm like this. And if you have a current.
About 20 people turned out to learn the basics in oil spill response Tuesday morning. For a couple of hours, the bingo hall in Dillingham served as a classroom where the students, so to speak, got some basics in environmental safety.
This instruction will focus on the use of calm water or harbor boom because that is the type of boom pre-staged in the communities throughout Alaska.
From the bingo hall, class moved out to the airport, where DEC has a few Connex shipping containers set up. They're filled with all manner of stuff, like the aforementioned booms, those long, floating barriers that help contain oil spills in the water. There's also lots of rope, shackles, generators.
What was in that box, Ron?
There's a lot of cable and Tyvek suits, rubber gloves.
That must be the 300 feet of boom.
You can probably make boom out of that. I notice there's Typler up on that.
It's out here that we learn from DEC's Dr. Rick Bernhardt that now is the time of year when these materials are most likely to be put to use.
Fishing vessels tend to pile up on the rocks,
and have accidents. They've worked all season, long hours, hard work, they're tired. And it's usually those 2 a.m. trips back to port when somebody piles up on the rocks. So, we have spills throughout the year, but we really have a density particularly on fishing vessels in the next month or so.
After the airport, it's on to the boat harbor, where we get to see some of this stuff put into action.
You guys have a good anchor point over there, a large rock or something?
It doesn't take too long to get a couple hundred feet of containment boom strung across the harbor entrance. Dr. Bernhardt says getting this equipment ready and staged and even partially deployed is key in preventing damage.
Even if people don't deploy a protective strategy perfectly, if they can spend a couple hours getting it started, so when the professionals arrive, if they can only spend a half hour to touch it up instead of 3 hours to deploy it, then they're that much farther ahead of the game.
A pretty good turnout today.
It was. There were 17 people, and that's one of our best turnouts. So, yeah, hats off to Dillingham.
As an agent for the Marine Advisory Program at Alaska Sea Grant, and just simply as a resident, Gabe Dunham has a vested interest in spill response.
Well, it's certainly given me an idea of the procedure or the operations that are supposed to go on, the order in which you contact and notify the appropriate authorities, and just attending this event too, I can also it gives me a really good idea of what the response network looks like here in Dillingham. So I think that's helpful just to know who's going to be around when things like that happen.
Harbor Master Gene Barrett says he hopes those connexes out at the airport never need to be opened except for training days like this. But if they do, he's confident that training will translate to swift, effective response.
As a whole, there's enough entities involved in Dillingham between the fuel companies, the power plant, the city of Dillingham, and the state to be able to get boom in the water. And I think that's the most important part. I hope my boom, that we have the boom in the city's response container never touches the water.
On the off chance it does, the folks who participated Tuesday won't just be ready to help, they'll know how to help too. In Dillingham, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The rope along, and that makes it a little bit easier to let out boom or take it in as necessary.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Dillingham, Jacqueline Estes, Rachel Waldholtz, Annie Fite, Liz Ruskin, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.